Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Russian reaction to Trump's ceasefire plan hasn't been yes or no. So what's next? Does Europe figure into any of this? Also, we discuss the assault on democracy in Romania and Bosnia-Herzegovina. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He is international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with George in Budapest. George, it's amazing the reaction to the Russian reaction to the Trump plan that the Ukrainians have been forced to accept. That is, Vladimir Putin clearly telegraphed, and the reaction to that is all over the spectrum. We don't have enough time to talk about the various reactions to it all. So I want to get your reaction to Russia's reaction to Trump's plan, George.
Well, Russia's reaction was entirely reasonable because the plan on the face of it, okay, 30-day ceasefire, you know, maybe that's something to consider, but it went together with the announcement from the American side that they were going to use this 30-day period. In fact, they were going to start right away to deliver arms to Ukraine, and they were going to restart providing intelligence to Ukraine. Well, obviously, Russia wasn't going to accept that. I mean, in other words, a 30-day ceasefire while you continue to deliver arms and continue to strengthen Ukraine, you know, getting it ready for the next round of fighting. This then was interpreted by, the Western media, and especially by the Western political leaders, as Putin absolutely rejecting any attempt to negotiate a peaceful outcome. And then we had the culmination of this absolutely ridiculous weekend meeting presided over by Sir Keir Starmer, the UK Prime Minister, a coalition of the willing, in which they were absolutely determined to make sure that no possible peace agreement could come about. So, first of all, they declared that unless Putin accepts immediately and unconditionally a ceasefire, we will escalate our attacks on him. We're going to pressure him on economically. We're going to pressure him militarily. We're going to attack his defense capabilities. And then they said, well, anyway, and then we move on to the peace deal. And then this peace deal will involve our coalition of the willing, basically NATO and NATO allies, building a vast military infrastructure in Ukraine. Well, how on earth can Russia possibly accept any of that? But of course, the goal is to ensure that Russia doesn't accept any of that.
What's your take, Mark? Because I think George kind of summed it up very well. I mean, I have to expect that people in Washington expected the Russian reaction. I mean, they're not going to fold, particularly when the front is moving westward, not eastward. You know, I'm always very, very cynical about these things, but believe it or not, I think there is a little bit of wiggle room here if there was goodwill. It looks like there isn't, at least coming from the West. Mark?
Yeah, there is no goodwill, but let's be perfectly honest. The Russian answer, actually, if you translate it from Diplo speak, was not only no, but heck no. Right. I mean, it would be ridiculous for us to do that. We've got thousands of Kiev regime forces in Kursk surrounded, that their front there has crumbled. We're advancing all along the contact lines. And now that your proxies are losing badly again, you want another ceasefire in repetition of Minsk 1, Minsk 2, the Istanbul communique. And then you'll pump them through of weapons and give them more time to press gang people off the street. Streets into the military. No, we're not going down that road. Now, Putin did it very diplomatically. He says, yeah, we're not opposed to the idea. But then he proceeded to ask a series of questions, right? What about these troops that are trapped behind our lines? Should we just let them go after they've committed war crimes against Russian civilians and the atrocities in the Kursk region? Who's going to monitor it? Who's going to enforce it, right? This is a huge contact line. All these questions are designed to point out, first of all, the impossibility of all of this. Second of all, that this ceasefire agreement, cobbled together by the losing side in this conflict, which is the U.S. government and its Kiev regime proxy, is like something that a third grader cobbled together, from Wikipedia. It's in fact, Wikipedia could probably do better. This is not a ceasefire agreement, right? It has no ability to understand the actual complications on the ground. He just pointed out that this is essentially a half-baked stinking pile of feces, right? That's what he called it. We had this reaction from Europe that Putin must accept it, right?
He has no choice.
With the fury and the outrage. These are the same leaders that just a week ago were having a war summit with the Danish prime minister saying that war is better than peace and promising to spend 800 billion euros of fantasy money rebuilding their military industry that has deteriorated so far. Russia saw all of this. They've seen through all of this. But they understand that the diplomatic trap here is to paint them as the obstacle to peace, to put pressure on countries like India and Brazil that might be susceptible to...
Correct reading of the Russian reaction, and I think most people in the West do not want to do that. They willfully do not want to understand. But essentially, he's saying the ball is back in your court. Yep. We've given you our assessment here. But they don't really, the West doesn't want to interpret it that way. It's very childish and juvenile watching the Europeans. George, but again, I'm trying to look for some silver lining here. The Americans and the Russians are talking again. These are the two most important players in all of this. They seem to sincerely want to have communication. Number two, I wish I had it in front of me. I should have it. Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, said in December, Ukraine will be a member of NATO. And then a few days ago, no, not really. They said it in the Oval Office, too, the great showdown place that Trump likes to bring his visitors. So, that's something, isn't it?
That's right, Peter. Mark Rutte, and I think we've said this before, he's like the towel boy in the gym. I mean, he's just there to hand out the towels to the members coming in for working out. He essentially goes to the Oval Office, talks to Trump, and then pretends to agree with everything that Trump has just said. And praises Trump to the skies for having done so much.
You're saying a tongue bath, George.
Yes, quite. And then he takes part with the coalition of the willing with Sir Keir Starmer and goes along with everything that Sir Keir Starmer declared. So I think there are two things here. I do think that Trump, and not Trump himself, I'm not saying the people around him, but I think Trump himself, I think genuinely wants to bring this thing to an end. I mean, he hasn't quite figured out how to do this, but I think he does want to do it. And I think that he instructed his aides to present that as the reasonable path forward. And I think, as Mark pointed out, the Russians said, that's something maybe we can talk about and do something with. But there have to be certain conditions, and we can't simply have a ceasefire. And when you use that, the period of the ceasefire, just simply to strengthen.
To both of you, Mark. I think logically speaking, a ceasefire in lieu of a final settlement. See, nobody in the West is talking about a final settlement beyond Russia must surrender. Okay, that is the problem here. That's why I'll give it a listen. I'll listen through it all. Okay, if it really leads to something else, we're not there yet, Mark.
Yeah, we're not there at all. I mean, this is a fiction. The Europeans know that. That's why they got behind it. It was supposed to be a diplomatic attack on Russia, right? At least as far as they were concerned. What the Trump administration, you know, if they seriously thought Russia might accept this, I don't know what to say, other than they haven't done diplomacy, you know, and they don't understand the situation on the ground. But it's clear that they did read the Russian response correctly, because almost immediately we saw the U.S. Effectively, the Trump administration level new economic sanctions on Russia. There was sanctions put in place in early January by Biden against Russia's oil and banking sector, but there was an exemption for 60 days so the Europeans could buy the energy that they wanted. The Trump administration allowed that to expire, effectively putting new sanctions, which will only actually hurt the Europeans more than the Russians, but that's always been the fault with trying to sanction the world's largest commodity supplier. But Reuters has also reported that the Trump administration is now sending new improved ground launch small diameter bombs after the failure of the Biden administration's early sending of them. Supposedly, these now will be more resistant to Russian jamming through electronic warfare. I don't know about that, but it's obvious we see an economic escalation and a military escalation to punish Russia. This is done being very quietly while Trump continues to, you know, try to leave doors open to possibility. Russia, meanwhile, is trying to turn their no, because this is stupid, response to the Trump administration, but let's talk. They're trying to draw them further into a permanent diplomatic settlement. Meanwhile, the European threats of a coalition and troops on the ground is just meant to prevent any ceasefire from actually happening.
But George, I mean, you know, I said, you know, looking for the silver lining, there's an acceptance that Ukraine won't be in NATO. That's something that Russia has wanted. But the Russian-American bilateral relationship is restarting. But it can't. That restarting can't have any momentum if American arms are killing Russians. I mean, it's not sustainable. George.
No, it isn't. But I thought it is significant that Mike Waltz, when he was on Sean Hannity's show, essentially said, well, the things that we're talking about is no NATO membership for Ukraine and the Donbass. He didn't just say, well, Ukraine may have to sort of cede some territory. He said the Donbass going to Russia. So this is something that is actually being contemplated by the Trump people. The reaction of the Europeans is a state of panic. I mean, the reason why they're suddenly going so over the top and hysterical is that they're worried that their project might just disappear from them. So that's why they're
putting... All right, I want you to hold that thought, because we're going to continue talking about that project. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. George, before we went to the break, you were finishing a point. Go right ahead.
Yes, it's just that the Europeans were convinced that this Biden EU project of continuing this war indefinitely was now threatened by Trump. And so what they're now trying to do is put as many obstacles in the way of any possible agreement as possible. So that's why when they're talking about, hey, well, unless Putin accepts this ceasefire immediately and unconditionally, we are going to escalate our pressure on Russia. And if there is a final agreement, that will involve the coalition of the willing pouring in arms, pouring in their personnel.
Where are these arms? All I see is that let's go into debt. That's the only thing they can do. Go ahead, Mark, take it away.
Yeah, I mean, that's the crux, is they don't have any more arms. They don't. This is all threats without any substance, without anything to back them. If they want to spend $800 billion worth of debt, you know, to rebuild an arms industry that doesn't exist, scattered among 30-some different countries, that's fine. But talk to me in 10 years when you might see some results from that. In the meantime, they have no artillery shells left. They have no infantry fighting vehicles. They have nothing left to give Ukraine, which doesn't even have any men to utilize them. So these threats are baseless. All the threat they have now is putting European troops on the ground as human tripwires in Odessa, Kiev, and praying that if Russia calls their bluff and actually hits them, that the Americans, that Trump will come running to their rescue. That is all they have. And it is desperation. It is panic. It is the implosion of their entire worldview, identity, conception of themselves, and all the political capital, of course, that they personally have invested in this conflict in defeating Russia, which is all about to evaporate.
Well said. Gentlemen, I want to switch gears here. Let's talk about the state of democracy in Europe. George, you know, you and I have talked great length what's going on in Romania. In the first round at the end of last year of the presidential election, the winner was, he was denied his victory and not allowed to run in the second round. And I think that's still being litigated, but I think it's more or less for sure that he's not going to be on the ballot anytime soon. Another person stepped up, and she's been denied access to the ballot as well. This seems to be a trend. It seems like that's the cost of doing business when you're a member of NATO. You lose your sovereignty, you lose control of your elections because this has been so supported from the outside. Of course, the Russian boogeyman is always in the center of it all. Also, George, I'd like you kind of, if you can, or you want to do it separately, Bosnia-Herzegovina, what's going on there issues of who controls what and the outcome of, the NATO outcome of the breakup of the former Yugoslavia is still with us to this day. Most people don't know it, but democracy is really at play here. I thought that was the strong card of the European Union. I thought that was their value. They seem to be walking away from it like a New York minute. Go ahead.
No, that's right, Peter. The interesting thing with the Bosnia-Herzegovina thing is that this is a piece of unfinished business. So back in the 90s, the whole plan, the reason why NATO got involved in the wars in Bosnia-Herzegovina and then against Serbia over Kosovo was to lock these entities into NATO. That was why they wanted to do it, and to push Russia out of the Balkans once and for all. They acquired these agreements. There was the Dayton Agreement first over Bosnia-Herzegovina, and then there was the agreement for Serbian withdrawal from Kosovo. But since then, NATO hasn't really succeeded. So, you know, Bosnia-Herzegovina, essentially, it's still essentially a very divided state.
It's a basket case.
It's a basket case. And the part that the Serb part was, which is ruled over by Milorad Dodik, wants less and less to do with the rest of the Bosnia and Herzegovina. And according to the principles of national self-determination, which NATO used in the case of the Kosovo Albanians, according to principles, why should they be forced to live in a state they don't want to live in? So there's this constant pressure that they're applying against this entity in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And now that the politicians of Bosnia and Herzegovina have said, look, we don't really believe that these laws that you keep imposing on us, you know, such as that the forests, the agricultural land of the Republika Srpska belong to Bosnia and Herzegovina. No, they belong to us. They belong to the Republika Srpska. This has been deemed unconstitutional. And then this office of the High Representative, a completely unelected bureaucrat, invariably either a German or an Austrian.
I was going to say, which one is it? I don't remember, but it's always a German.
It's always a German. So, yeah, Christian Schmidt. who basically has no legitimacy at all for that position, says that, well, what you're doing is against the law. And now Dodik has been prosecuted, found guilty, sentenced to prison, and barred from political office for 5 years. And an arrest warrant has been issued against
him. But he still walks the streets unfettered.
This is where it becomes interesting as to what exactly NATO's plans are, because there's also these constant mass protests in Serbia. That's another part of the equation that really NATO hasn't resolved. You know, they wanted to get Serbia into NATO, abandon Kosovo, and turn it against Russia. You know, they tried, first of all, with the kind of liberal anti-Milosevic people. They failed there, so they decided, okay, we'll switch over to these nationalists. Maybe the nationalists will play ball with us better than the liberals.
Okay, no, that
doesn't work either.
That brings me exactly where I wanted to go, because, Mark, you know, when we look at issues, how fragile and damaged now Romania's democracy is, and I'm throwing in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the common thread, and this is something Western media will go as a go-to point, it's NATO. It's not a European Union thing per se. It is a NATO thing. And it's because of issues of Georgia just mentioned, what kind of relationship Romania or its part of its population, at least, and the Serbs in Bosnia-Herzegovina, their attitude towards NATO policy in Russia. That's the common thread. Mark.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, the EU and NATO are simply meant to be complementary institutions that complete the geopolitical consolidation of Europe under, you know, some type of quasi-federal technocratic control, whether that control is centered out of the United States with NATO or with liberal technocrats in Brussels is another issue. The idea is to that the EU primarily becomes a national identity, nation destruction machine, right? Solidifying that central control, except in Eastern Europe, where nationalism is encouraged as a bulwark against Russian influence. That's, of course, always the contradiction. But in Romania, this is the next time any European, any member state of the EU tries to lecture another country anywhere in the world about democracy. Don't forget, I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's a zillion examples like this. But in Romania, the new candidate, right, she's the leader of a conservative party. She's running to replace Gorgescu. She's run before. We know why she was banned before, because it was spelled out. Her pro-Russian views and her critique of NATO are a threat to Romanian democracy, right? This is practically, you know, a quote here. This is a managed democratic system, quote unquote, democratic. Some views are acceptable, some views are not. In foreign policy, you are not allowed to have foreign policy and geopolitical views outside those approved by the technocrats in Brussels and NATO. And if you do, you're simply, and you actually have a chance of winning, you're not allowed to run. That is not democracy, of course. That is some type of authoritarian system.
Yeah, but George, at the same time, the person that claims to be the president of Ukraine, his term has come to an end. They refuse to have elections. Before the special military operation, opposition parties were dismantled. Independent media was dismantled, though they say the USAID came in and recreated that space, which it didn't. But there's no critique of that in Western media. But they have to manage Romania's elections, and of course the default position is that Serbs in Bosnia-Herzegovina have no right of self-determination. It's really interesting how these things float at the same time, right next to each other.
That's right. The interesting thing is the response of the media. They parrot. They're saying, well, of course, there's martial law in Romania, and that, of course, means that you can't have elections, according to, not Romania, Ukraine.
Iraq had elections during war. Afghanistan
had elections. Afghanistan had elections.
United States was in a civil war. They had elections.
South Vietnam had innumerable elections. And then again, if you look in the constitution of Ukraine, where does it say that you can't have elections during martial law? It's just invented out of whole cloth. And then the media repeat this, just like with the Georgescu. They said, well, he's supported by Russia. It was a Russia-led some kind of a campaign. And of course, all the evidence is that this TikTok campaign, which it, of course, is itself irrelevant as to whether he can run or not, even if there were a TikTok campaign, was actually done by a kind of a liberal opposition party in order to weaken the conservative opposition. So it had nothing whatever to do with Russia. And so when they say, oh, he's pro-Russian, he has not in any way pro-Russian. It's like when they say Viktor Orban is pro-Russian. No, he was pro-Romanian or pro-Hungarian. They say, we want to stay out of this war. It has nothing to do with us. And it's very dangerous.
To remind particularly our American audience, you know, Romania is very close to Ukraine, okay? It's very close to a war, okay?
Right.
And the closer you are to it, the more people, with the exception of the Baltics, the more wary they are of it. Mark, 30 seconds goes to you. Go.
Yeah, I think we, need to have a broader assessment of all of this panic and desperation on the foreign policy front, this political repression at home. And it's punctuated even more by what is becoming increasingly evident that the EU is not a great power, right? They completely lack hard power. Increasingly, their soft power has completely eroded with their hypocrisy.
All right, Mark, on that,
you
named the two most important things about their soft power there. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.